Welcome to First Response, a podcast from First Liberty Institute discussing religious liberty with those who are defending it. I'm Jeremy Dice, one of the attorneys here at First Liberty.
And I'm Justin Butterfield, another attorney here at First Liberty Institute. And Jeremy, I understand that you just got back from signing your will.
Indeed I did, Justin. Nothing like going through a worldwide pandemic knowing your will needs to be updated. But I guess going through law school, you realize the problems that can happen if you don't have one. And as you know, it's biblical. Proverbs 13:22 says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children.
Well, that's great, but you don't have any grandchildren, Jeremy. So did you leave me anything?
Less than the hair that is on my head.
Is that even possible, considering that you're bald?
You know, there's a Bible verse about that too, Justin. People mocking those who are bald in 2 Kings 22, 23, and 24. So just be careful about all that.
Well, that's two Bible verses, Jeremy. And yes, I'll keep an eye out for any bears that come around. But back to religious liberty. I feel like this has been the first week in a while that I spent more time on non-coronavirus-related religious liberty matters than on issues arising from the government's response to the coronavirus.
Yeah, I don't know which I spent more time on this week, but you're right that I finally feel like I'm starting to keep my head above water on the coronavirus-related matters, and I can start to think about everything else that's been going on that is not directly related to the coronavirus.
Out of the frying pan and into the fire, huh, Jeremy?
That's right. But we're not really out of the frying pan yet. We're just, like the rest of the country, in that transition phase. And in fact, today's guest has a fascinating inside look at what Congress and the administration are thinking when it comes to that transition, the reopening of America, as well as how it impacts religious liberty.
Well, our guest now is Representative Mike Johnson, a United States representative from Louisiana's 4th District, who is a member of President Trump's Task Force for Reopening America. Representative Johnson is also the ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. Before he was in Congress, Representative Johnson worked as a civil rights attorney, defending the right to life, religious liberty, free speech, the Second Amendment, and free market principles. Representative Johnson, thank you for taking the time to join us, and welcome to First Response.
Hey, my friends, great to be with you all as always, and thanks for doing this important program.
Thank you. Now, Representative Johnson, you have a unique perspective on the issues that religious organizations and places of worship are facing, as you spent years defending the religious freedom rights of religious organizations, and now you're on the Task Force for Reopening America, which provides policy advice to President Trump on how and how quickly to reopen America. So you understand both the needs of America's religious communities and the considerations that we must take into account as we slowly reopen the country. What, from that vantage point, do you think the key issues in reopening America's religious organizations and places of worship are? And what have been some examples of good policies that we've seen implemented around the country with respect to that reopening? And what have been some problematic policies?
Yeah, those are really important questions. You know, the immediate concern, I think, that a lot of our churches and houses of worship, nonprofits had around the country was just survival, frankly. I mean, there was a real problem early on in the pandemic with having to close the doors and these kind of draconian shutdown measures around the country. And a lot of our churches, people don't think about often, run pretty much like small businesses, really. They have payroll, they have employees, they have people who serve those communities of faith. And when they were shut down, their income or their revenue stream is, I mean, it sounds crass in a way to say it, but it's the tithes and offerings that come to the church. This is the way God designed it, is the operating funds of that local organization. And so when people stopped coming, obviously a lot of those tithes and offerings declined. People in their own homes have concern about their own income levels and sustainability and all that. So it had a big effect on the churches. So we were really grateful to include the churches and nonprofits. We fought really hard, several of us in Congress, to ensure that they would be included in the Paycheck Protection Program, which is the PPP everybody's heard so much about. And I'm really grateful that a lot of churches took advantage of that, and it converts to a grant, and it's allowed them to maintain their payroll. Now we have emerged and are emerging through that valley onto the other side. And now there are a whole host of new challenges. And among those are, I would say, one of the top concerns that I hear from pastors all around the country is concern about liability. And some people listening to our voices may scratch their heads and say, well, no, what's the deal there? Why is that a big concern? Well, because we know that, you guys know, I know, I was in that arena for 20 years before I got to Congress. There are people out there, and there are litigation groups, their lawyers, who seek to prey upon the churches. Again, that sounds harsh to say, but it's reality. And we believe that and we've seen anecdotal evidence already, that there are groups that are circling the waters like sharks, looking for vulnerable churches, food banks, nonprofits, communities of faith to bring lawsuits against. Why? Because if someone goes to one of these churches, if they receive a box of food from a food bank, and heaven forbid someone gets infected, they would then bring a lawsuit to challenge the church or the food bank or the nonprofit that was offering those community services, and claim that they're responsible. And so we have to address that aggressively. I'm so grateful for the work of First Liberty Institute and what you guys have done out on front, and that encouraging Congress to see and understand that issue and respond to it. And I'm grateful that we're working on that even as we speak.
Well, Congressman, I'm glad you've been able to join us today. And you recently said something publicly, which you've said kind of again here, which was, while public health must remain our chief concern, it is urgent that the state give small businesses, churches, and nonprofits a fighting chance at survival. I think that's well said, but we've recently seen governors making statements like, churches may not be able to reopen until a vaccine is developed. And we've even seen police officers, as with one of our clients at First Liberty that we represented in Mississippi, he said to the client that his rights had been suspended for just simply trying to hold a drive-in church service. I think we all hope that a vaccine is going to be developed soon. Keeping churches closed indefinitely until one is developed is clearly not in the spirit of America's love of freedom, particularly our religious freedom. And the idea that churches' rights can be suspended is just wrong. So talk to state and local officials for a moment here as they debate how to reopen America's religious institutions so that those institutions can have a safe chance at reopening. What's your advice to them? And then what is your advice to churches and other places of worship that are facing, in some instances, these really draconian, authoritarian type of demands that would deny them that fighting chance?
Well, that's, again, it's a series of great questions. I wish we had a three-hour program, guys. We could dive in deep on all of this. But I'll say, at the surface level, it's exactly right. Of course, you guys and I and everyone who works in our field, we often refer to the religious freedom as our first freedom, our first liberty. Heck, it's how you got your name, right? And it is an inalienable right that is given to us by our Creator, and it is sacrosanct in America. We protect it and guard it jealously. And even at the time of a public health crisis, that freedom and that inalienable right is not taken away. The state does not have a right to step in and just with a broad brush say, oh, I'm sorry, you can't meet for worship anymore. It just doesn't work that way. And so we have to be, this is an education process in some sense. In another sense, sometimes it requires litigation on our end to defend that freedom. And I'm glad you guys are out on the front lines doing that. But we can do this safely. The reason I made those emphatic points is that I've been saying since this began that we can protect lives and livelihoods at the same time. Those are not mutually exclusive pursuits. We can trust the American people to do the right thing, to be creative, to innovate, to implement, sanitation protocols and practice social distancing where appropriate. Those are not rocket science ventures. These are really simple things to do. And people of faith and these communities, the nonprofits who serve their communities, these are the most vigilant people there are. They're in the business of saving and protecting lives in a spiritual sense and otherwise. And so you have to allow them the chance to do that. When these draconian measures are implemented on a local, state, or even federal level, and we've been able to limit the federal level to a certain degree, that sometimes they have to be challenged. Sometimes you have to take a local officials aside and say, think about what you're doing. We can help you protect public health. We can implement practices. The CDC has come out with a list of recommended, options and guidelines and things that communities of faith and faith-based organizations can implement to help ensure the safety of people. And I think I've seen already a lot of churches doing that. We went to church on Sunday, and in our local church, it's a very large one. There was a smaller number of people there because some people above age 65 who have comorbidities or in higher risk are rightfully staying home right now. They're watching online, right? But other young people and young families want to gather together. And so what our church did was they allowed them to come, and they marked off every other row in the church. They had appropriate distance between families and people who live together. And it worked well. You know, the challenge was, frankly, we're in the deep South and everybody loves to hug. And so the inclination is when you walk in the door to greet, everybody runs up and embraces one another. We got to be careful about that, right, for a while. But we're not going to wait around for a vaccine to meet as the body of Christ, to meet as churches, communities of faith. That's not an acceptable measure. And I think I'm really glad to see that most of the governors now acknowledge that.
Representative Johnson, I wanted to follow up with something that you touched on a little bit earlier, and that is the threat of lawsuit abuse. I'm sure you've seen First Liberty Institute recently sent a letter to members of Congress on behalf of ourselves and several hundred religious organizations and faith communities really raising that very issue. And, you know, even though lawsuits like that should prove meritless, lawsuits where a person maybe received food or shelter from a charity or attended a church service and then came down with COVID-19 and is seeking to blame the religious organization for that, even though those should prove meritless, you know, the cost of defending those lawsuits alone could bankrupt and drive out a lot of religious organizations and ministries, especially as they're generally finding themselves financially struggling, as you talked about earlier at this time. But as Congress is presently in the midst of considering new stimulus and relief packages akin to the CARES Act that we saw a few weeks ago, what are some things that Congress can do to protect religious communities and charities from the threat to their survival from the lawsuit abuse? And what do you think is the likelihood we'll see any sort of relief from that threat in any upcoming legislation?
Yeah, great questions again. I have been working really hard with colleagues in the House and on the Senate to advance those ideas. And thank you all so much for that letter. It was signed by some of the top religious leaders in America, some of the top most well-known Christian leaders and organizations. And that was really helpful to our effort. In fact, I took your letter and put a cover letter of my own on that and sent it over to our colleagues in the Senate and the Senate Judiciary Committee. And my colleague from Louisiana, Senator John Kennedy, introduced that letter, as you all know. So we have legislation pending right now in the final stages of drafting in the House and the Senate to provide exactly the liability protections that you're referencing. And what we're saying in this legislation is that, you know, if churches and nonprofits and food banks and homeless shelters, if they've made a good faith effort to follow health and safety guidelines, many of them are complex and really disparate. So you might have a set of guidelines from the state or the local, the county, and they're not always work together. And so it's a very complex set of new and novel, it's a novel virus, and it's a novel problem that we have of all this labyrinth of regulation now. So all we're saying is a very simple, common sense solution here. If a local organization, a nonprofit, is making an effort in good faith to comply, that they ought to be protected from liability lawsuits. We ought to have the standard for negligence here to be something like willful conduct or criminal negligence that's just so gross and obvious that we could protect everyone else. And so that legislation is in process. My colleagues in the House, Vicki Hartzler and Doug Lamborn and a number of others are assisting to get that done, and we're advancing it as quickly as we can. The prospects of its passage are good, I think, because I think we can get a bipartisan consensus. I chair the Republican Study Committee. That's the largest caucus of conservatives in Congress. We have 148 members in the House. I can tell you every single one of those will probably co-sponsor this. And I believe we can get a sufficient number of Democrats who are reasonably minded on this to help. I believe it'll pass the Senate. I believe the president will sign it into law immediately, of course. But in the interim, it may take a while to do it because Congress, as you know, has suspended operations for the time being. We're only meeting sporadically, to our great chagrin. And so what I've asked the president to do, talked with the White House about this just in the last several days, I'm asking the president to consider issuing an executive order to the extent that he can to cover liability issues for churches and nonprofits in this interim period. And so we'll see how that turns out. They're examining their legal authority to do that, the scope of it right now, even as we speak. In the interim, though, I put out on social media and in my channels that I have just a simple suggestion that it would not be a bad idea, probably, until we can get this legislation passed, for small business proprietors and churches, nonprofits, and everyone else to display a disclaimer or kind of a welcome notice at each facility entrance. Now, I know these, waivers of liability have varying degrees of success in courts in different states around the country. So there's all sorts of caveats here, but this just is common sense. I just drafted a little welcome notice that says, "We're so happy to have you join us today." And then it, in smaller print, it says, "Please know that we've taken special precautions to secure your safety and prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Still, no facility can provide a guarantee against exposure or infection." And then it says in larger font again, "Please enter at your own discretion." So something simple like that, there's nothing magic about that language, but it would help, I think, to put persons on notice that, you've done the best you can. There's no guarantees here, but we're going to get about life in a safe way because we have to reopen society, and we hope that you'll participate knowing all the risks that are out there for you. So it couldn't hurt. It may not be the silver bullet at the end of litigation, but I think it's a common sense measure. We'll see how all this comes out. I'm very optimistic about the legislation. It just may take us a little bit of time to get it done.
Well, that's very helpful insight, and I think it reveals this entire discussion of how complex the situation is, not just from the medical standpoint and from the pandemic, but also the myriad effects that have come out of that, everything from religious liberty to potential tort litigation down the road of things. But as we kind of draw this conversation to a close, let me end with a question we've put out to most of the guests on this program, including your colleague Vicki Hartzler and a couple others that have been on this show before you. We've been hearing some really interesting answers to these questions, so it's always good to repeat it. And that is this: what do you think America is learning about religious freedom, its religious communities, from this pandemic? And how do you think America's approach to those issues will be different 6 months from now than it was before the pandemic hit us?
That's a great question. I think that people have been thinking about these issues maybe now more than they ever have before. We've learned that our freedom, even the most basic, even the first freedom, religious liberty, is not anything that we can ever take for granted. And if you think that those freedoms are not under assault every day in America, you're wrong. And now I think a lot of people are seeing the threats that exist from various angles. And so, it's a reminder, I think, to all Americans, freedom isn't free. It's something that we have to vigilantly guard and protect. And sometimes, unfortunately, even well-intended government officials will infringe upon liberties as kind of a knee-jerk reflexive reaction to circumstances that happen. And so we have to be very, very careful in this country to never sacrifice liberty for the sake of security. We can do both things. They're not mutually exclusive, and we have to remind everyone of that. So I think on the other side of this, I think there's an awakening. And as my pastor said Sunday from the pulpit, he was so grateful. It was the first time everyone was back at church. And he said, "Y'all, I just don't," he's a Southern Baptist pastor. He said, "Y'all, I don't just love people. I'm addicted to people." We're made that way. It's how God made us. We're in his image. We're communal by nature. We're about relationship, and that's something we can never take for granted either. So maybe this is a good wake-up call. It's got given a lot of people time with their families and to focus on the things that really matter, and hopefully that'll sustain us in the days ahead. We're going to need it.
Well, Representative Johnson, thank you so much for joining us here on First Response. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I know our listeners really appreciate your taking the time to talk with us today.
Hey, appreciate the work you guys do. It's never been more important, so keep it up.
Well, Justin, that really was a fascinating conversation.
Yes, it was. And as I was thinking about the discussion of why it is important to include churches and religious organizations in the CARES Act's Paycheck Protection Program, apart from the obvious that we don't want America to be a place where religious organizations are excluded from benefits merely because they're religious, but it reminded me of a 2016 study that found religion provides up to $1.2 trillion, that's trillion with a T, to the U.S. economy, and that benefit is being threatened because finances are tough for everyone right now, including for religious organizations that do so much.
Yeah, just think about all that religious organizations provide. Schools, food, shelter, hospitals, and right now even just helping at-risk people buy groceries. And of course, not all of that is threatened, but a lot of what religious ministries and religious organizations do requires staff and has the same expenses as anyone else, while often serving the communities least able to pay for it. So with charitable giving so low, and I think that's understandable given how many jobs have been lost in the last couple of weeks, it just makes sense for religious organizations to be included, just like everyone else, in the Paycheck Protection Program, in addition to being what the Constitution requires.
Well said, Jeremy. I think that's exactly right.
Well, let me ask you about another part of what Representative Johnson said in that same vein, the risk of liability, or even just the potential for liability that invites lawsuit abuse from people who may maybe received food from a food bank or shelter at a church and then got COVID-19, maybe not even from the food bank or the church, but now they're threatening to sue. And the potential threat, the potential that even that threats that have to bankrupt organizations that are already financially strained.
Yeah, and this is an area where I think Representative Johnson's being in Congress and on the presidential task force gave him a fascinating insight, because he was able to share that he thinks protection on that point is coming both from Congress as well as possibly in the form of an executive order, but that in their interim, religious organizations should consider posting notices that warn attendees that, you know, COVID-19 remains a concern, and while I know the vast majority of religious organizations are working hard to disinfect surfaces and take precautions to limit the spread of COVID-19, there's really no guarantees in this that someone won't contract COVID-19, even with every precaution taken. So I think that was wise advice.
Yeah, I agree. And I suspect we'll be seeing notices like that everywhere in the coming weeks, not just at religious organizations.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm sure, you know, there are many lawyers who are overly excited right now at the thought of all those waivers they can ask people to sign.
Oh, now tell me, Justin, don't tell me you don't love a good liability waiver.
Jeremy, I've written a few myself, but I would rather find a less time-consuming approach to fighting lawsuit abuse than requiring people to sign 10-page forms in triplicate before walking into a building.
Yeah, you're right about that. That may be a new form of dystopia you've just described.
Well, I hear West Virginians like you are great at bringing down dystopian societies, Jeremy.
You know, I'm no Katniss Everdeen, and I'm not very great with a bow and arrow, but I do love to shine a media spotlight when the fundamental freedoms enshrined in our Constitution are ignored.
Well, on that note, Jeremy, I think that's all the time we have for today.
Yeah, and for those of you who are listening, if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to First Response on iTunes or Google Podcasts, and be sure to rate us and leave us some listener feedback when you do.
Yes, and be sure to visit firstliberty.org, where you can follow all of First Liberty's work, whether coronavirus-related or not, and you can learn about ways that you can support First Liberty in its mission of defending and restoring religious liberty for all Americans. But for now, I'm Justin Butterfield.
And I'm Jeremy Dice. And this has been First Response.